All right. Good morning, all. And I hope you wore your traveling clothes because we're going on the adventure. I see some bright spots of red. There must be some people like I who like red and blue and such. You know, this is a good traveling color, isn't it, you see? Anyway, I hope you have on your comfortable traveling clothes and traveling shoes. As I just picked up in the bookshop, the announcement for the C.G. Jung Foundation, looking through it, I couldn't help but be struck by the fact that in July here, there will be a lecture called Chaos and Order, Two Sides of One Coin. And since we were talking about this, here is the quotation from C.G. Jung himself. In all chaos, there is a cosmos. In all disorder, a secret order. In all caprice, a fixed law. For everything that works is grounded in its opposite. It takes man's discriminating understanding to recognize this. Isn't that a wonderful statement? You see, that's what we were really talking about. And so that on this journey, if the winds seem capricious, you see, as they seemed to Odysseus, and I hope you're all going to take on your Odyssean selves today, as it were, your Homeric selves. We might even have a little experiment in how we can become Odysseus. I hope you will realize that if the winds are capricious, there really is a law. There is a guidance, as it were. There is a lawfulness that is pushing along your craft. So today the journey begins. And so who's taking the journey? I think we might spend a little time just exploring together who you feel is taking the journey. Who am I? Who is this that says I am about to take this spiritual journey? Remember, we're talking about a spiritual journey. Who am I? Who is this that's taking the journey? Anybody have any idea? You're going to have to decide. Maybe you want it to be the mask. Maybe you want to have something behind the mask taking the journey.
You? I'm being brainwashed by theosophy.
Ah, so you see. Well, all right, so have I, you see. So who?
I believe, you see, that it is the immortal spiritual self that is me.
All right, the immortal spiritual self. And that's what's taking the journey. Mm-hmm. All right. Any other ideas?
Spark of the divine.
Spark of the divine is taking the journey.
Whoever I really am.
This is interesting, you see. Yes.
I believe that the spiritual I am being and the personal being need to get into touch and have a kind of a good relationship.
Mm-hmm. So that they...
You see some people where these two particles are enemies?
Mm-hmm. So that the spiritual self and whatever this being is here need to get in contact, and that's what the journey is about,
yes.
Is bringing about that inner union, as it were, that contact at least, so that we're speaking together.
Yes, I've got that thought. Worked to that from one of our friends committed suicide.
Uh-huh.
And so they must have had an enmity.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Themselves.
But this is interesting. That's an interesting, and hold on to that idea. Is there a kind of enmity between parts of ourselves? We may have to look at that. Yes, Hubert.
Another suggestion is that it's God who's taking the journey through my eyes.
God's taking the journey through my eyes. Ah, good. Interesting to see how we frame this, you see, of who is really taking the journey. So you make up your own mind, but you've got to have some idea about who's taking the journey, you see. If there's going to be a journey, you see, you're going through you're now moving in a new direction. This is a spiritual journey. We'll be looking at some of the images today. I'd like to look at quite a number of them as time permits, and part of it you're going to, this afternoon, get around to it. We're going to climb a mountain together, and you're going to finish the story and see whether you get to the top or not. Now, do you take anything with you? Have you got anything with you on this journey?
One discipline says there are tools.
There are tools, all right. What are you going to take with you?
Your past experiences.
Your past experiences, all right.
Past
your past behavior patterns, yes. You know, it's very interesting. You see, when you talk about past behavior patterns, some writers, and Jean Houston among them, suggest that Odysseus, for example, took that past behavior pattern in the sense that he blundered into things. That the call to take the journey comes as a kind of blunder. One trips over something and one blunders, you see. Perhaps one makes a mistake along the way. And this may be a past behavior pattern, a behavior pattern out of the past. And so that is what we take with us until we really learn that that behavior pattern perhaps doesn't always work, and we have to get out of it. But we have to take all of our past with us, you see. We have to, you know, it's very interesting to see what we take with us on this. Odysseus also, at one point, to point to the Odyssey, at one point, on the island of the Cyclops, you may remember the Cyclops, the one-eyed giants and so on. He had to disinvest himself of his identity. So having just asked you who is taking the journey, perhaps we have to, what do we take with us is our identity. And there may come a time when we have to disinvest ourselves of our identity. That's going to be interesting, isn't it?
Is that the mask?
It may be the mask, it may be, you know. So, that's why I've sort of pushed you on. I'm not going to give you answers, but I'm just making suggestions that you begin thinking about this, you see. So, examine what you're taking with you. How much baggage do you carry?
Too much luggage.
Yes. I try to travel, you know, as someone who has traveled all over the world, I try to travel fairly lightly, but I never quite succeed. I do leave home, you know, stoves and bird cages and so on, and some things that you see people travel with, get off airlines with, that always amazes me. Particularly in a country like India, where you see them get off with huge bedrolls and with stoves and with you know, all kinds of gadgets and everything, and the mounds of luggage they have around them, you see. Yes, some of you know. So from one point of view, I travel fairly lightly. I always remember an experience many, many years ago. When Mr. Jinarajadasa, who was one of the former presidents of the Theosophical Society, arrived at our headquarters in the United States. And he had come through the Pacific War Zone, believe it or not, by ship. And he came loaded with trunks and suitcases and baggage. It was a huge mound of baggage. And he was going to do a bit of a tour in the United States, and accompanying him was one of our very well-known members, one of the founders of our Crotona Center of Theosophy in California, Miss Mari Poots, a beautiful woman, not outwardly but inwardly, an amazing person. And she was to accompany Mr. Jinarajadasa. And he came ready to go on the tour with, I don't know, perhaps 5 suitcases and, you know, a tremendous amount of baggage that he seemed to carry with him on the tour. And as it was all being stowed in the car, I was standing there. We were the whole group of us of our headquarters staff there to say goodbye, wondering, you see, how Miss Poots would ever get any baggage into the car to be taken to the train, because in those days you traveled by train, not by air, of course. And so we were waiting for her. She came merrily down. She had one little suitcase, you know. That was it. She was going off, and here was Brother Roger with about 5 bags, and Miss Poots with one little suitcase, and I thought, my goodness, if I could ever emulate that, it would be a miracle. But you see, what do we need to take with us? Well, obviously, we have to take ourselves with us. We take our past with us. Do we take anything else with us? We take enthusiasm, yes. We're ready for the adventure, yes, yes. And we take courage with us, don't we? So what are these qualities? So you see, it's interesting how you would answer this question. What do you take with you? Kevin? You may take expectations, and they may weigh you down, your expectations, you see. And this, again, in physical terms, has very interesting connotations. You see, I expected to rain, you know, in New Zealand, so I brought a raincoat. You know, I expected to be cool, so I brought, you know, heavier clothes. But also, this tour, arriving in New Zealand, was preceded by a tour in Queensland. Now, what's Queensland like? Can be very warm, can't it? I was up in Cairns. Believe me, it was hot. I obviously didn't want something that is on, well, this isn't fully wool, but has a bit of wool in it, but a heavier jumper. I didn't need it in Cairns, so you have to carry some other things. So you see, even there are analogies all along the way in this, aren't there, you see? And it's interesting how you answer this. Now, is anyone your guide? Is anyone going with you? Perhaps guide? Perhaps I should put there companion? We can use companion. Or guide, however you want.
Conscience.
Yes, all right, your conscience. That's an interesting answer. Trust. Faith, yes, shraddha, confidence, faith, you see, trust, all right, and conscience, anything else?
Other travelers,
perhaps, yes.
This usually sounds sort of teacher, but it seems to be as much grounded in yourself as well as what you find outside.
That's right, so you have your own inner compass. Can we put it that way, Murray? Yes, we have your own inner compass that's sort of giving you a direction on this journey, you see, that sort of trues you now and then, as it were, keeps you true to the course, more or less. You see, Odysseus was fortunate. He had Athena, who appears in a variety of disguises. And you have to watch out for this, because the gods and goddesses take all kinds of disguises. Not always recognizable. It may be the beggar standing on the street, maybe a god or goddess sort of pointing the way. You know, you have to be very careful. It may be a chance encounter in the waiting room at the airport. Maybe just a very chance encounter that gives you a new direction, as it were, and so on. So you have to be very alert to these little hints, you see. So look at who or what along the way.
Obviously, you must also have your knowledge to date,
That's right, your knowledge to date. Again, you have a certain inherent knowledge, and a knowledge that you have gained through a certain number of years of living. That sometimes it's It's a knowledge that is very helpful in determining the way in which you want to go on this journey.
It now, might be the tool.
Hmm?
It might be the tool.
It may be the tool, yes. Very true, you see.
God is also my God.
God? Yes. What do you mean by God?
The inner self and the outer and everyone else.
All right. So, you see, we have to really look at it, what we mean by these things. You see, God is my guide, but who is God, you see? And so we have to, what do you mean by these things? So you have to look at this, you see.
Would you say that pointers along the way are opportunities?
There may be opportunities that are pointers along the way that suddenly come along, yes.
Something else perhaps not mentioned here, but those companions are a similar sort of stage. This is what we are here.
And that's what we are here, yes. So we're moving together, yes. Maybe the scriptures, you may take along a favorite book that sort of readjusts your thinking, you know. You may carry something.
You need maps and guides, that way.
You may have maps and guides. You may have maps that sort of help you, yes.
And timetables and things like that.
Yes, it's useful to have a timetable, perhaps. Yes, depends on the trip you're taking, isn't it, you see? So you have to look at these things. You have to examine these things. Now, is it important to know where I'm going? You see, what is your Ithaca?
Perfection.
Perfection?
Realization?
Learning.
Hmm? Learning, all right. You see, a lot will determine, as you may change your goal, you may change your direction, but a lot will be, of the whole path, will be determined if by really what you perceive as the goal towards which you're moving, you see. A great deal will open up based on perceiving what is that goal. Where am I going?
You've got to be extremely aware.
You don't dare fall asleep on this journey. It's amazing, you see. And of course, that's what often happens to people, is falling asleep. But it's very interesting how we begin. And so I just thought by starting with those few questions, it might be useful to examine before we just get started on some of the images that develop.
Another point on that last one is that there are many diversions on the way. So where am I going? You might start for a particular place. You get diverted on the way.
That's right. There are many diversions. Oh, many diversions. And it's very easy to get diverted, isn't it? You know, very easy to get diverted. Well, it's impossible to speak without really resorting to the use of metaphors. And metaphors always evoke images. So today we're going to look at a lot of the imagery and see if it makes sense. Metaphors, of course, are really older than the written word. They've been shaped into fables, into folk tales, into parables. And they're found in the writings of poets and mystics. They've been used to teach, to offer insight, and to persuade. Metaphors are basically comparisons, of course. And in our world of manifested existence, we've already pointed out, I think, that would we know light without darkness? Would we know pleasure without pain? We know it through what have been called the opposites, but which are really polarities. And these metaphors, and I hope that what we experience today in this sense, in terms of metaphor, in terms of image, they work on both the conscious and the unconscious. Our conscious minds respond to very simple comparisons. I've used some already with regard to what we take with us, you see. Comparing physical baggage to the kind of interior baggage that we carry around. We all carry around our own pasts. We all carry around our own internal baggage, don't we? So, on the very simple level, there are these simple comparisons. But our unconscious, whether we know it or not, is intrigued by complex metaphors and searches out, really, the unconscious does this, searches out the purpose, the meaning behind the elements in a tale or a fable. And we'll be looking at some of that today and tomorrow. Metaphors influence us in very subtle ways, really. Fairy tales, folk tales, myths are metaphors that present, really, potential points of view, other ways to look at events. Now, we all of us employ metaphors. We all develop images. And I'd like you to think for a moment of the image that is your image. What kind of image do you have? What kind of, you know, in a very broad sense, I don't want to make it too specific in asking this question, but what is your unique image? It's very interesting, or you can think of it as your symbol, you see. A friend of mine, a very dear friend of mine, was going through a very, very difficult period at one stage in her life. Extremely difficult period. She developed a kind of, and I think we all do this, a kind of little, shall I say, not superstition, but a little device by which she would judge whether the day was going to be a good day or not. And that was by seeing a certain sign, a certain little image that was a V like this for victory, and it sort of came out of, you know, the Second World War, you remember, this was the V for victory, and a sign that seemed to indicate that that would be the way that everything would move forward. That became a kind of symbol, a kind of image. And it was interesting at that particular period, that kind of sign, that kind of image appeared on a certain make of automobile, on the hood of the car, you know, was this kind of image. So you may have a kind of image, and I'd like you to think about your image, because we'll be working with images, as I say, and every journey contains its own metaphor. We're all the time being addressed by images. Sometimes, as I say, we look for certain signs, which are really metaphors for understanding reality. We even may say, driving through the countryside, if I see a white horse today, I know it's going to be a lucky day. Now, the white horse does not in itself bring us good fortune, we know that, but it's a metaphor or an image of how we think the universe should behave toward us. You know, the universe should be kindly.
Yeah, would I be getting off the track today if I suggested that as long as we have a condition that we have to see a specific image of the good day, we condition ourselves to having a bad day, we don't see it?
That may be, you see, that may well be that we may condition ourselves in that way. But on the other hand, it may be a device that helps us, you see. It may be a very helpful device, you see. I frequently, when I'm traveling, I wear this particular pendant, which is the emblem of the Theosophical Society. Now, I do it because I feel it's a kind of protection. Maybe that's a kind of superstition, but it's a kind of protection. And we may, in some ways, have this kind of protective devices, you see. So that may be the image, too. That may be the metaphor. I don't always wear it when I'm traveling, but generally I do wear it when I'm traveling. So I'm just using that as an example. So think about what your image is. We respond to different images in different ways, and to different metaphors in different ways. Take the story of the ugly duckling. I presume all of you know the story of the ugly duckling who turns into a graceful swan. Now we have an intricate and very lovely metaphor in that story. An image that speaks to us at both the conscious and unconscious levels. Consider just four possible meanings. I'm going to give you four meanings and see if you can think of a fifth meaning. We'll do it that way. One meaning of the story might be, there's no ugliness, there are only differences. All right? You can see that. A second meaning, there are others who look like you somewhere. You see? A third meaning might be that even when things look bleak, there's no need to despair because change will come. It is inevitable. And a fourth meaning, you're really beautiful and mustn't forget that, even if those around you never recognize your beauty. Now, can any of you think of a fifth meaning?
Someone's to your outer personality. Mm-hmm. Well, the white swan would be your spiritual nature. Mm-hmm.
White swan is the spiritual nature.
And so it's saying beauty is interior.
Beauty is interior.
Okay. You cannot see who you have seen as opposite
person. Ah, very good, yes. You need to see the opposite in order to recognize beauty. Interesting, you see. Out of that one simple little tale, we can derive quite a number of different meanings, can't we? So, as I say, every journey contains its own metaphor because we are all the time being addressed by images. All the time. What's that, Charles? Don't be deceived by outward appearances. Yes, don't be deceived by outward appearances. Very true, you see. So as you think about that, if you even take a simple story, as I say, like the ugly duckling, and begin to think about it, it begins to work inside of you. Really begins to work inside of you. And you begin to see deeper and deeper meanings in it. I recently came across a statement by the contemporary musician-composer Michael Tippett. I'm sure Hugh knows Michael Tippett's works. And it's a marvelous statement. I was so excited when I came across this. He said, I know that my true function within a society that embraces all of us is to continue an age-old tradition fundamental to our civilization, which goes back into prehistory and will go forward into the unknown future. This tradition is to create images from the depths of the imagination and to give them form, whether visual, intellectual, or musical. For it is only through images that the inner world communicates at all. Images of the past, shapes of the future, images of vigor for a decadent period, images of calm for one too violent, images of reconciliation for worlds torn by division, And in an age of mediocrity and shattered dreams, images of abounding, generous, exuberant beauty. Isn't that a magnificent statement? Jocelyn, I expect you know Michael Tibbetts' works too, don't you? Yes. And many of the others of you may, but I'm sure that his name is well known in musical circles. But I was just so captivated by that statement of his. Sometimes our journey begins with confronting the dark side. In fact, it has always been said that if you really are in earnest in undertaking any spiritual practice, you'll be confronted by darkness, by your dark side. And it's very interesting to follow through many of the myths. As you know, in Dante, of course, his journey begins, as you may remember, it's a marvelous beginning. In the middle of the journey of our life, you remember I said yesterday, Jung suggests that it's around the age of 35 and so on. So here again is Dante at this point, you see. The middle of the journey of our life, I came to myself in a dark wood where the straight way was lost. That's how it opens. Isn't that marvelous? I came to myself in a dark wood where the straight way was lost. And he goes on, oh, how hard a thing it is to tell what a wild and rough and stubborn wood this was, which in my thought renews the fear. So bitter is it that scarcely more is death. But to treat of the good that I there found, I will relate the other things that I discerned. I cannot rightly tell how I entered it, so full of sleep was I about the moment that I left the true way. But after I had reached the foot of a hill, there where that valley ended, which had pierced my heart with fear, I looked up and saw its shoulders already clothed with the rays of the planet that leads men straight on every road. It's a magnificent beginning, isn't it, you see? This opening, you see, and so he says, then the fear was somewhat calmed, which had continued in the lake of my heart the night that I passed so piteously. And as he who with panting breath has escaped from the deep sea to the shore turns to the dangerous water and gazes, so my mind, which still was fleeing, turned back to see the pass that no one ever left alive. And so he goes on and, of course, enters into the darkness, really the darkness in the inferno, you see. So we have the images of our darkness. And I think we have to look a bit at this because there are really four aspects to the images of darkness. And don't think that you confront them only at the beginning of the journey. You say, read St. John of the Cross, the dark night of the soul, you see. These images of darkness may arise and sort of come deeper and deeper. But it's interesting to examine some of these images of darkness. Sometimes we see them as a battle, as indeed Odysseus did. As I say, Odysseus, rather than waking in the middle of a dark wood, as Dante did, Odysseus begins with this terrible blunder. In fact, he keeps making blunders. In one sense, you see, there are two aspects in the life of Odysseus, and you can look at, again, if you're going to be Homeric in this or Odyssean in this. The first is that he was the victor at Troy, remember. He was the great hero of Troy, wasn't he? He's the one who devised the Trojan horse, you know, the horse that brought the Greeks in that finally defeated Troy, and so on. And he, you know, if he'd been sensible, what would he have done? He'd gone straight home. But he didn't, you see. He was so filled with his own importance as the victor. And this is why I said, you know, who are you and what are you taking with you? He wasn't satisfied with the loot he had, as it were. He wasn't satisfied with all he had achieved. And it's very interesting, one can analyze the Odyssey on and on. You see, there are 12 ships, there are 144 men, 12 times 12, and so on. The number 12 plays an important role. What is 12? 12 signs of the zodiac and all the rest. But he becomes so filled with his own importance that he sails off to rout this other, I can't remember the name of the place that he's going to take his men and he's going to conquer this other little island, you see. And I'm sorry, I don't remember it at the moment, which I should, but... As I say, he could have gone straight home, and instead of that, he sails north to lead a pirate raid on Ismaris, yes. And he, you know, he becomes so, and we do, you see, at the outset, we think, well, I can conquer anything, so I'm going to go over here and really conquer this, instead of getting on your way, because we get so filled with our own self-importance and self-conceit. Very dangerous, very dangerous. And that's his first mistake, of course. And then his second mistake, throughout, he blunders, is that he is so curious about everything. His curiosity gets him into all kinds of trouble, you see. And we have to be a little bit careful about that, too. But the pilgrim is curious, but how far should that curiosity lead us, you see? All right, and it may push you back, and it may lead you into new images of darkness. So as I say, don't think you meet these images of darkness once and for all. You're going to meet
them. You can't meet darkness just by not being curious.
Hmm?
You can't
move. That's true, even by just not being dark, by being curious, very true. You're going to meet it all along the way. But there are really four aspects to the images of darkness, and we can look at them. There are the biological aspects of the images of darkness. Very interesting. There's the cosmological darkness. Cosmological aspects. I'd like to look at these a little bit. Because this is an interesting aspect, and these you can't avoid. There's the cultural darkness, cultural images. Culture. Not doing very well on that. There are the cultural aspects of these images of darkness, and there are the personal aspects. So we can begin to examine some of these images of darkness, as it were. And we have to deal with this. You can see it as a battle, as a kind of struggle, which is the same thing as a striving for light. We find some of these images very much in the writings, for example, of the great mystic Hildegard of Bingen. And I'll refer to her again. They're very powerful, and it's interesting, she calls her images illuminations, you see. If you want to, the illuminations of Hildegard of Bingen, tremendous. All right, the biological dark side is perhaps the easiest to understand. It takes, you see, in a sense, the logic of the biological dark side is very easy it's very simple. What hurts me is dark, is evil. What hurts me is evil. The attacker is evil. The disease is evil. The storm is evil. Our life, our very biological life, makes us vulnerable. You see, It really does. And this is the biological dark side. It's been said it takes a living thing to experience pain and horror, and we're all living beings. So even biologically, you see, others bump into us. We catch unknown diseases biologically. So there's a biological dark side that has to be faced, that has to be somehow endured. It's built into our bodies, a kind of fear of what's going to happen. Theft can occur. We can lose what we're carrying with us, you see. And I'm thinking of just dealing with the fact that we are in physical incarnation. And in physical incarnation, we take this journey, you see. So we have to deal with it. The logic of the natural world is perfect in one sense. Nature keeps well what benefits survival, what works. So at times it seems that evil works, you know. And biologically we have to confront ourselves. This is why, you see, in some of the traditions, it is said that one does not undertake this journey of the spiritual life without perfect physical health, which may seem a very strange statement. I refer you to H.P. Blavatsky's little work, Practical Occultism, you see, as one of the, this is one of the ancient, very ancient proposals. One can say, well, certainly HPB has enjoyed anything but perfect physical health, and that's true. But this is one of the prerequisites often, because you're going to go through this journey, not just inwardly, but the physical body may be subject to attack. So face it. So there's the biological images of darkness, the biological aspects of these images of darkness.
Well, he also says that a time of illness can be a time of withdrawing from the world, whereby you can actually begin the journey.
That's right. It may be what sets you forth on the journey. Very true. Very true.
Eventually, any psychological effects will impact upon
the physical vehicle. Very true. So you have to be ready for that, too. Yes.
And it may be, having started out with the impulse because of the physiological reason, you may, on your journey, gradually build up and build up till you reach the perfect physical state.
This is very true.
If you're on the right journey. Mm-hmm.
If you're on the right journey, this is very true.
Isn't evil basically ignorance?
It may be ignorance, but it may also be, you see, what attacks the physical that really, you know, supposing you're traveling, and I'm talking about physically now, supposing you're traveling in a country in which English is not spoken, an alien land, a unfamiliar territory, physically I'm speaking about, and you suffer the theft of all your money, your passport, and you see. All right. So here again, what do you take with you? Comes back to that.
American Express.
Yes. Never leave home without it. Your American Express card. Yes, you see. But
couldn't we see the physical barriers as a challenge to our reaction to it?
It can be. Very good, you see. How do we meet these things, you see? How do we meet these contingencies? It's very interesting, you see. So it's very, very interesting to observe, you see. lost luggage. Believe me, this is no fun. No fun at all. You see, arriving as I did in Monrovia, Liberia, without my baggage following me from Accra, Ghana, and having to stay there for 4 days because the next flight to Buenos Aires was 4 days later, you see. So there. Yes, they are. There is a darkness about it. So don't pass this over quite so lightly, is all I'm saying, you see. Be alert to it, that we have to take the physical body with us on this journey.
Joey, a thought occurred to me that when one does get to this stage of putting one's foot on the path, isn't all your heaped up garbage thrown at you?
It is.
You are smothered in it temporarily.
Temporarily, you really are. Yes.
Uh-huh. So, in a way, it's a quick calm. You're resting everything.
Yes.
By attempting to do this path.
Yes. So you're risking everything, you see. The price is not less than everything. This is true.
Joy, isn't that a point? Your son, you put it in the too hard basket straight away and miss that opportunity and spend the rest of their lives kind of having regrets. They just feel that in this present life they can't deal with it,
perhaps.
They know that.
Yes.
Perhaps they feel cowardly or whatever it is, but they just don't.
But there are times that people feel, I just can no longer deal with it, you see. And this is very true.
I'm not quite understanding why these are images of darkness. Are you equating darkness with difficulties, problems?
It can be. It's a kind of shadow side that comes up to confront us, you see. It's a barrier. It's the shadow side, which, and fear is there, you see. So it's, you see, it. I'm saying these are aspects of these images of darkness. These are aspects of how we, as you said, how we react to it. We may need to stop and take time off.
Usually when you're in the darkness, you can't see out of it.
You can't see out of it, yes.
You're involved in it.
Yes. You know, there is nothing that interrupts meditation. So, you know, this is, if we say that meditation is a practice on this spiritual journey, believe me, there is nothing that interrupts meditation so greatly as a toothache. All right?
True story.
True story, you know. You see? So you have to really look at that, to the biological side, the aspect that arises, that really confronts you.
And so I think, to put it in a nutshell, perhaps the essence of this darkness is a feeling of isolation and powerlessness.
Yes.
And perhaps being sunk in your own negative or small nature.
That's right.
For the time being.
Yeah, that's right. So it's there. Now the cosmological side, I must finish by 11, is that right? Yes. Let's look just briefly, but begin to think about it. In one sense, the cosmological dark side is ultimately the most terrifying. This is the statement, the endless wheel, as it were, the prison planet created by in the Gnostic tradition, you see. This was created by the Demiurgos, you see. This is we're bound here. This is this feeling of the way in which dukkha is translated by much of Buddhism, that all is suffering, you see. It's a cosmological condition. The anguish that is inherent in being human in this manifested system. The overall anguish which can't be explained away. And of course, it only appears terrible, but that's often the way it appears, that the cosmos itself is unfriendly. And very often it appears this way.
Dark. It can lead to real despair.
And it can lead to absolute despair. This is the existentialist view, that it really leads to complete despair.
Must be the feeling of impotence.
That's right. Of greater forces than our own, do you see?
Where does the idea of the crucifixion fit in this darkness thing?
It can be at any one of these levels, in effect. It can be that all of life is a crucifixion, and that's a cosmological feeling, that the cosmos itself engulfs us. Now, it can be the light side of that is that the cosmos is love, you see, but love that punishes too, that brings about the anguish. So we see it from the other side. But when that feeling of complete isolation in the cosmos, that the cosmos, you see, is really terrifying, that we're aliens in a strange land, strangers in a strange land.
You know.
Mm-hmm. It arises this awe, yes. You get a great deal of this in the prophets of the Old Testament, don't you? A great deal of this feeling, you see, that awesomeness, that the whole cosmos, the majesty of the creative being Yahweh, is you know, hanging over you. This is the ultimately great dragon fight, in that sense. Yes, of course. That's right. But we forget it at such moments when you feel that the whole universe is somehow, you see, suffering with you. And that feeling of anguish and of angst, of real genuine fear, not for the body, but for the, you see, that it can engulf the whole being. It's a tremendous feeling. You feel so small, so limited, so little against.
It's strange, though, isn't it, Joy, that it's only humans that personally think invisible.
Yes.
Animals,
yes. No. That's
do you
right.
Think, do you think this is more like looking to other extraterrestrial existence, so we don't feel so alone in the universe?
So we don't want to feel alone in the universe on this little planet, you see. So we hope there's life out there. Is somebody else listening, you see?
Somebody else even experience
it. Yes.
Is this what I have? Is this the idea of hell?
Of what?
Hell.
Yes, of course, you see. Yes.
And yet there's another side to that, isn't mm-hmm. there? If you lose that awe mm-hmm. that the cosmos is bringing to you, mm-hmm. and you face up to some part that's mm-hmm. worrying you, you seize it, you use it,
yes.
you use the different yes. parts of the cosmos, mm-hmm. you yeah. build them to do what you want, and mm-hmm. you become very full yeah. of pride.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. But it's interesting. You see, there are some Buddhist practices that begin with the most horrible kinds of meditation on corpses. You see, that help you to face this cosmological darkness that engulfs us. Meditation on the most horrible, repulsive things you can think of, you see. Very interesting.
Joy, are these really, these images of darkness really responses mm-hmm. by what Madame Blavatsky would talk, speaks of as the personal self?
Yes. Well, of course, but it's the personal self that has to be taken. Remember that it's in physical incarnation that every step on the spiritual path is taken, according to the theosophical worldview.
Essentially, it's a psychological response of the personal self
at these various levels. But these two form, in one sense, the backdrop of the whole journey. We can let go of these, but these form, as it were, a backdrop. Because you're in physical incarnation, and you are part of the whole cosmological system. So that's the backdrop. And so it is a psychological image that arises, yes. But it becomes the backdrop of existence.
To remember that situation being so, there would be no necessity for life.
That's right. And no necessity for the journey. This is the entry into this. You can call it the entry into the inferno, which is where Dante began. We'll be looking at that a bit later. I think we will get to it.
He doesn't actually say why he began at that point, does he? He just
begins there. But that's, well, it's because where he has to begin. Where else to begin?
Is this where we all begin, perhaps? Is this where we all begin, perhaps?
I think we all begin there. We
no,
really... Well, but ultimately you have to, a real beginning is there. We are seated in this cosmos. We are biologically seated in this universe.
And he gives the magic word that he awakens.
He awoke, yes. He awoke there, you see. And he sees the mountain, and we'll look at that. Well, let me, just before we break for tea, for the morning tea, let me just briefly point out that the cultural dark side, which I think is exemplified by all the violence on our television screens and by all the crime and oppression that we see going on in the world today, it surrounds us so completely that perhaps we've become numb to it in a sense. The violence of the cultural dark side is so vast and is so deeply entrenched that we feel we can't do anything to avert it. We must depend on a certain luck to keep us safe, to walk our streets and so on. Today, you know, really, this issue of safety, is it safe to go out? Is it safe to even be inside my house?